Finally, you know those movies you pull out time and time again when you're not sure what to watch? Well, our colleagues at Weekends on All Things Considered have been asking filmmakers and actors about the movies they never get tired of watching. Today we hear from actress Paula Patton. She's known for her roles in Precious and Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, and she tells us about one of her favorites.
Trailer for sale or rent.
Hi, I'm Paula Patton, and I'm an actress, and the movie I've seen a million times is Talladega Nights, directed by Adam McKay, starring Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly, Leslie Bibb, Gary Cole, Sacha Baron Cohen, Molly Shannon, the list goes on and on.
It's a hot one here in Talladega.
I first saw Talladega Nights when it came out in theaters, for sure, and laughed my butt off.
Hey, shake and bake, gal!
It really spoke to the American dream, and yet it made this great commentary on our culture.
Ricky Bobby, today's big winner. Heck of a win.
Well, Dak, here's the deal. I'm the best there is, plain and simple. I mean, I wake up in the morning, I piss excellence.
I can't tell you how much I use quotes from it in my daily life all the time. Like, if you're not first, you're last.
Always remember, if you ain't first, you're last.
If you ain't first, you're last.
See you when you're,
see you when you're all grown up. I don't say that to my child, but I love it.
Okay, next up is Ricky Bobby. Ricky, is your father here?
No, ma'am.
Talladega Nights is about a young kid whose father leaves him.
But my mama says he's out racing cars and, well, dipping his wick in anything that moves.
And somehow this kid, from nothing, rises to be this great race car driver.
Ricky Bobby with yet another impressive win. He is dominating NASCAR.
And then a French man comes in named Sacha Baron Cohen.
My name is Jean Girard. And I am a racing car driver just like you. Except I am from Formula 1.
And he rattles Will Ferrell's cage, and then he suffers a deep failure.
Yep, I'm flying through the air. This is not good.
Ricky! Cool!
And somehow he finds his way back up. He finds his strength. And I think the moral of the story is it's okay to be second.
I just went out there and drove and knew that no matter what happened, my boys, my mama, and my lady would love me.
My favorite scene in this movie, it begins with Leslie Bibb's character going,
"Supper's ready, come on, y'all, I've been slaving over this for hours."
And then Will Ferrell begins to do his prayer, and he goes,
"Dear Lord, baby Jesus, or as our brothers to the south call you, Jesus."
And he goes into a whole baby Jesus thing, and Leslie Bibb's character says, "You know what, he's a man, Jesus was a man." And he goes, "Listen,
I like the Christmas Jesus best, and I'm saying grace. When you say grace, you can say it to grown-up Jesus or teenage Jesus or bearded Jesus or whoever you want."
Then John C. Reilly's like, "You know, I like to think of my Jesus in a tuxedo T-shirt.
Because it says, like, I want to be formal, right, but I'm here to party, too. Because I like to party, so I like my Jesus to party."
And it's one of the most perfect scenes because it makes you laugh so much. And I say baby Jesus so much now in my own personal life. Thank you, baby Jesus. I could go on forever. I love that movie.
That was actress Paula Patton telling us about the movie she's seen a million times, Talladega Nights. And that's our program for today. At Tell Me More, though, the conversation never ends. You can check out all of our stories on the web at npr.org/tellmemore. You can also follow us on Twitter or find us on Facebook. The handle is @TellMeMoreNPR. And remember, if you missed our barbershop on Friday, you can find the podcast in the iTunes store or at npr.org. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. We'll be right back.
If you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. On this Father's Day, we turn now to a man who's helped change the way we think about and care for our children from the time they take their first breaths. For the better part of a century, Dr. T. Barry Brazelton has been studying babies and sharing his knowledge. He hosted the long-running TV show What Every Baby Knows, and he's written more than 30 books on child development. Hospitals worldwide rely on his newborn assessment, known as the Brazelton Scale. And at age 95, the renowned pediatrician is still going strong. His latest book is called Learning to Listen, A Life Caring for Children. It begins with his own boyhood in Waco, Texas, where his grandmother made the prescient observation, Barry's so good with babies.
Well, she'd put me to work every Sunday on the front porch of her house while my parents went in to have cocktails and get drunk. I would sit out there with six younger cousins and have to take care of them for about 3 hours. And so right from the first, I learned that if you watched a baby and listened to them or a child, they would tell you what they were about to do. And I could stop them before they got in trouble, not afterward.
This seems radical at the time because really up until World War II, in which you served, people didn't think of babies as separate beings who had personalities, right?
I think because we lay them out on a cold slab, didn't swaddle them, and then confronted them with noises and sights, and these kids wouldn't respond. They'd habituated. So as soon as you wrap them up and cuddle them and bring them up to an alert condition, they'll do anything you want.
I'm going to try that on a few people I know. But you know what? You know, that brings me to something about this book. It's a bit of a travelogue in places. And what's really fascinating is the years that you have spent doing extensive research into the ways that other cultures approach caring for newborns. How would you say that American methods of early parenting compare?
I don't think it compares very well. I wish that parents were like the parents I saw in Kenya or in southern Mexico, where they carry their babies around and learn about them right from the first. Unfortunately, in this country, we tend to put a baby down, tend to talk on our cell phones rather than looking at him and speaking to him.
I was so taken by your description of mothers and babies on Japan's Goto Islands. And these are remote little fishing islands. Tell me about what you learned there. It's quite remarkable.
Well, we spent several years there studying babies. And we realized that these mothers never move fast. They never got excited. They spent most of their days knitting nets for their husbands fishing. And so when the babies were born, they were already very quiet, gentle. And when you picked up a baby in the Gotos and got him alert, he would follow you back and forth for 24 minutes without a break. And then I did the same study on babies in Tokyo with the same genotypes, mm-hmm. and their mothers rush around. So this 24 minutes was already down to 18. And then when I went to Los Angeles, it was down to 8. So it taught me that intrauterine experience is very important.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I've learned over there was how wonderfully these mothers were treated right after a baby came.
This is amazing.
They were treated like newborns. They were wrapped up with the baby, and they were put on a futon with nothing to do but nurse the baby. They also were picked up and taken to the John and fed like a baby. There was absolutely no postpartum depression.
Oh, my goodness. Is there anything that a modern, typical American mother, what can we take from the Goto Island mothers?
I think we've got to fight, like I have, for longer parental leave. so we can keep mothers at home and have a chance to learn about their babies, learn about themselves as parents. I would like to hope for 6 months, but we're down to 3 months in this country, and that's really not enough.
When you were starting out, Dr. Brazelton, right after World War II, could you have envisioned yourself still plugging away many years later at age 95?
No, I certainly couldn't.
Does it feel like you've seen it all, or do you continue to learn from babies and young children?
Oh, golly, I don't want to give up. I learn every time I see a new baby, every time I talk to a new parent, I learn from them.
Renowned pediatrician Dr. T. Barry Brazelton. His new book is called Learning to Listen, A Life Caring for Children. Dr. Brazelton, it was such an honor. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you, Jackie. This was wonderful.
And now we turn to another college admission story. In 1961, Phyllis Richmond was a young writer and researcher who developed an interest in urban planning. After taking a couple of courses at one Ivy League school, she decided to try pursuing a graduate degree full-time at one of the country's most prestigious, Harvard, and she started the application. But before she could put the finishing touches on it, Richmond received a letter from one of the professors serving on the admissions committee. He said they liked her application, but he asked her to consider her, quote, responsibilities to her husband and a possible future family, unquote, and described to the committee how she planned to make it all work. Richmond says the letter so discouraged her she didn't bother to finish it or answer the letter. But 52 years later, after an award-winning career as a restaurant critic and writer, Richmond changed her mind, and she did pen a reply, and the Washington Post recently published it. And she's with us now in our Washington, D.C. studios to tell us more about it. Phyllis Richmond, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you, Michelle.
When you started that application, did you think that there would be some resistance to you going to grad school full-time?
I didn't expect resistance from that, and I did worry about how I was going to do it, about how I was going to pay for it. It never occurred to me that I would be given less consideration because I was a woman. I knew women in the field, and I had grown up in a planned community in Greenbelt, Maryland, which was a project of Eleanor Roosevelt. Women and planning were very well connected in my head.
So when you got the letter, can you just describe for us, you know, all these years later, just what went through your mind? I mean, how did that feel?
I had forgotten that there was a letter, but I had had a talk with the man who wrote the letter, an interview with him. And he told me that his prime example was that his wife had a planning degree and she was home raising children. That didn't seem much of a deterrent to me. Children grow up. And it turns out that they had 3 children in 4 years. Of course, one of them would have to be raising these children. And she went on to have a, what seemed to me, an illustrious career in planning. But she certainly inadvertently played a role in my not going into planning.
The professor you're speaking about here was a Professor William Doble. Did he say that that his wife felt that her education was wasted or that
he felt it was wasted?
It wasn't just him. I mean, one of the things you wrote in your piece is your letter shows just how much Harvard, not to mention my husband, our families, and even myself, didn't give my career the respect it deserved when I was starting out. I mean, talk about that for a minute. I mean, was it really all Professor Doble being a jerk?
You know, why didn't I fight him on it? Well, it wouldn't have been in me to fight authority, for one thing. I accepted what he said, and I certainly didn't like it, and I didn't think it was fair, but it was what the world was like for me at that point.
What made you want to write this response all these years later? You mentioned you were going through a box of mementos, and you came across the letter, and you said even though you'd met with him, it occurred to you you'd never really responded to the letter. What made you want to do that now?
I have a daughter, and I have a niece, 2 nieces, who look to me as a model for their behavior. I felt very proud, humbled by that. And so when I saw this letter, I thought, this is the kind of thing that she's talking about, that she's proud that I'm a model for her in standing up for my rights. So I thought, now is time to respond to this. I showed this letter to my daughter, my niece. They were appalled. They were horrified. And I was relieved that they were appalled. I didn't know whether women today took it for granted that they had a rightful place that was given to them when it was appropriate.
One of the things that you said in your letter, in your response, was that the arc of a career can be long. That it doesn't have to be that a woman pursues a career in the same way that a man does. That you can take breaks or divert from task and then return to the task. And you cite, again, Professor Doble's own wife, who did return to the academy, did return to the profession, and went on to have quite a distinguished career.
Well, women's careers, at least then and perhaps now, just take more circuitous routes. I was taking graduate courses for the time that I was raising children. I was working on a thesis, a master's degree. I started freelance writing. So at one time, I was raising three small children and writing and in school. You have to be flexible when you're trying to do this. And I was flexible enough that I found writing, that I recognized writing as the career that I really wanted at that point.
So your beef is not that the question is asked, but that it was only asked of women, that why weren't the men being asked, what do you plan to do with this?
Right,
how do
exactly,
you plan to make it
exactly.
work? Yeah, you did get a response, Professor Doble.
Yes.
Were you surprised that you got a response?
Well, actually, it was the post-editor's idea. I thought it was a great idea. I had been trying to contact Professor Doble for weeks, and they managed to track him down and send him a copy of my article and asked him if he would reply. I was excited that he was going to do that. I was disappointed in the reply, but I was glad that at least he knew this was coming and had a chance to participate.
People can go to the Post website and look up both the original article, your original letter, your piece, and his reply. But he says in part, "You were about to make a considerable investment of time and money. I thought it fair that you be aware of employment conditions as I then perceived them." He also goes on to say he would never have written such a letter today. But you said you were disappointed with his response. What did you hope for?
It was not employment conditions he was concerned about in that first letter. It was whether I would continue my career, use my education. And in fact, I did after that work in the Philadelphia City Planning Commission and the Redevelopment Authority and City Planning Project. And I did use the education that I managed to eke out. And I think it also informed what I wrote in Food as well.
When you look at the whole thing together, what feeling are you left with?
Well, I do wish that I had been bolder, but I'm glad that I had the chance to embolden my daughter and my nieces. And I've loved my career. I've had a wonderful professional life. But I also would have been excited to have the chance to go further in planning.
What would you want people reading your letter today to draw from it? I noted that you got a lot of responses to the letter.
Oh, it's
many,
been
many stories from people telling their own personal stories. Mm-hmm.
It's worthwhile making sure the next generation knows what happened with your generation. You still have to be aware of whatever injustices you participate in or you're affected by. And you still set your own general path and keep on that as best you can.
Phyllis Richmond was a restaurant critic for the Washington Post from 1976 to the year 2000. She responded 52 years later to a letter she received in 1961 from a Harvard professor who cautioned her to consider her family responsibilities before applying to her program. And she was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Phyllis Richmond, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure, Michelle.
Just ahead, many African Americans have had a complicated relationship with the issue of same-sex marriage.
We'd seen the Black community being considered more homophobic than other communities, and that became a narrative that was throughout the press.
Now a new film asks if that's really true and what might change that. We'll hear from the director of The New Black. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
The
Okay, Scott just made clear economic issues have some competition for top billing at the G8 summit in Northern Ireland. We do, though, want to drill down into one economic question this morning, and that's why interest rates here at home are going up. The bond market has pushed them to the highest levels in 15 months, and that includes mortgage rates. Let's turn, as we often do, to David Wessel. He's economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. David, good morning.
Good morning.
So what interest rates are we talking about here?
Well, the very short-term rates, the ones that banks pay each other when they borrow overnight, the ones that consumers get on their savings accounts or money market funds, are still very, very low, nearly at zero.
Okay.
But longer-term rates are up. The ones that the Treasury pays when it borrows for 10 years, the one companies pay that when they sell bonds, and importantly, the ones that homeowners pay on new mortgages. The benchmark rate is the 10-year Treasury, what it costs the Treasury to borrow for 10 years. At the beginning of May, the government borrowed at 1.6%. Today, they're paying about 1.25%. That's still very low, but it's up quite a bit as these things go.
Up quite a bit, it sounds like. And what about those rates on mortgages?
Well, they tend to move with Treasury bonds. 30-year fixed-rate mortgages are now at 4.15%, the Mortgage Bankers Association says. Just a few months ago, they were only 3.5%. That, of course, makes it more costly to buy a house. Probably not enough more costly to snuff out the recent increase in home prices. That's because a lot of houses are sold for cash these days, so mortgage rates don't matter. And for another, 4.15% is still pretty low, lower than they've been in the memory of most Americans. But it is taking a toll on refinancing. At these rates, fewer and fewer people are deciding to refinance their existing loans. That's actually costing the banks some money because they make money on the fees from refinancing.
I guess, David, the next question is what this tells us about the economy. Why is this happening now, and what can we read from it?
Well, there's a big debate about why this is happening now. The good news version is the U.S. economy is finally healing. Rates are heading back towards normal as the market anticipates better times ahead, a day when the economy will no longer need the extraordinary efforts of the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates very, very low. But the bad news version is that the markets are misreading the Fed. The market thinks the Fed is more optimistic than the Fed really is. So the market is pushing up rates in anticipation of the Fed doing something. That could put a brake on the economy prematurely. It's a reminder that we're living in this huge economic experiment, and no one, whether the Fed or the markets, is quite sure how it's going to work out, especially when the Fed starts to wean the economy off of extraordinarily low interest rates and easy money. Now, which is right, the good news or the bad news? Well, I don't really know. The Wall Street Journal, we surveyed 50 private economists last week, and three times as many blamed misreading of the Fed. Basically, this is a mistake, as blamed a stronger economy, the good news version.
Okay, so everybody's trying to read the Fed and decide what the Fed is going to do. What is the Fed going to do?
Well, one thing the Fed is going to do is, after a meeting they have this week, Tuesday and Wednesday, Ben Bernanke is going to have a press conference, the Fed chairman. Now, he kind of started all this on May 22nd with some congressional testimony that roiled the markets, not only here in the United States, but all over the world. So basically on Wednesday afternoon, he has a choice or a chance to either muddy the waters further or clarify the situation. I think one message he's almost sure to try and deliver very emphatically is the Fed is thinking about scaling back the $85 billion a month it's spending to buy bonds. That's to keep long-term rates down, because it is feeling a little better about the economy. But some people in the markets have thought that that means the Fed is preparing to move sooner to raise those very short-term rates. And I expect Mr. Bernanke to be pretty emphatic and say, we're not doing that until the unemployment rate gets much lower. And that's not going to happen any sooner than we said.
All right. Well, I'll be watching for that press conference Wednesday from Ben Bernanke.
I'm sure you will. It's almost as good as that Norwegian television show.
That's right. Something else we reported on earlier in the program. Boring television. David, thank you for always clearing up the muddy waters for us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
David Wessel, he's economics editor from the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. Open concluded yesterday at the Marion Golf Club just outside Philadelphia. And for American Phil Mickelson, this was another case of always the bridesmaid, never the bride. Mickelson finished as runner-up at the Open for a record sixth time, despite leading for most of the tournament. In the end, it was England's Justin Rose who took the prize, winning his first major tournament. And for a recap of all the drama, we reached USA Today sports columnist Christine Brennan, who covered all the action. Hey, Christine.
Hey, David. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. probably better than Phil Mickelson. My goodness. He leads all the way through Sunday and then again finishes second. What is he cursed or something?
Yeah. Oh, Phil, don't you just, you just go shake your head. I mean, he shot a 74, four over par on Sunday after, as you said, leading or being tied for the lead all three rounds.
Yeah.
Instead of rising to the occasion, he made too many mistakes at key times, double bogeying two of the first five holes, bogeying the shortest hole of the golf course later on. You know, here it was, his 43rd birthday, Father's Day, his 22nd U.S. Open,
three days
after flying overnight to get back to Marion after his daughter's eighth grade graduation.
Oh.
It appeared that it would be magical. And instead, as he said afterward, he said it's very heartbreaking. You know, it's certainly one of his last chances to win the Open. He was in great position. Perhaps, you know, that last opportunity that just got away, he'll have many more chances to play the Open, but this was a great opportunity for him.
But handled it gracefully, it sounds like.
Oh, he's terrific. Class act all the way. And signing autographs, David, in the darkness, both Saturday and Sunday, dozens and dozens of autographs. Who else does that?
Well, so Justin Rose, from England, who actually wins this, I mean, did he do something special to come back yesterday, or was it just about Mickelson's mistakes?
Well, I think it was also about Rose just playing even par, steady eddy golf when everyone else was making mistakes and hitting the ball into the water and out of bounds and doing almost anything else you can imagine you might see on a golf course. So he's a battle-tested 32-year-old European Ryder Cup player. He shot 70. And then he had a one-over par total for the tournament, two shots ahead of course, Phil and Jason Day. And I think he was he was really smart about it all. You know, he was patient. He said he had a game plan, and he stuck to it. He wanted to think his way around the difficult golf course shot by shot, never getting ahead of himself. And he's ranked fifth in the world, lives in Orlando, 14 professional titles. So even though most people hadn't really heard of him, he's not unknown, and this was his time.
So someone who a lot of people have heard of, Tiger Woods, did not play steady eddy golf, using your term, it sounds like. Not a good day for him, not a good tournament for him.
No, he never looked comfortable, David. The world's number one. He finished tied for 32nd. He was 13 over par for the tournament. It was his worst score in relation to par in any major he's ever been in as a professional. He just seemed out of sorts from the get-go. Now, people who watched noticed that he was shaking his left wrist, and he did say his left elbow was bothering him from a tournament a month ago, but he wasn't using that as an excuse. But he has now gone more than 5 years without winning a major, and
wow,
he really has to be asking himself what went wrong.
Well, Christine, what about the course itself, Marion, outside Philadelphia? There had been a lot of talk that this course was no longer really up to par to hold a tournament
That's
this
right.
big.
It was established in 1912, which is a long time ago, the year Fenway Park was open and this Titanic sank, you know, and had not been used for 32 years by the U.S. Golf Association for the U.S. Open. People thought that it just couldn't stand up to today's technologically enhanced players. Well, it did, and having no one under par, no one even at even par, was outstanding because you saw these players humbled. And it also made it fun because it was a strategy. It was more of a chess match than a game of brute force.
Hmm.
We don't see that very often in any sport. It was nice to see the past chalk went up over the present. Historians and purists just had to love it.
Sounds like a fun weekend to watch. Christine Brennan, always good to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, David.
She's sports columnist at USA Today telling us about the U.S. Open. Let's look now at another change in healthcare, and this one has to do with paperwork. Hospitals and clinics are slowly replacing paper files with sophisticated electronic health records. But with a variety of systems in use, they often can't easily share medical information with each other. And this can be a pretty serious problem in the case of an emergency. As Elizabeth Stawicki reports, smartphones might be one way to bridge this electronic gap.
It's one of those holiday surprises no one wants. A family member is visiting from out of town, and they get sick. That happened to Farzad Mastashari's 76-year-old father, who was visiting from Boston last Thanksgiving weekend.
My dad comes downstairs, and has acute pain in his eye where he'd had cataract surgery. And I said, what's the matter? What's the story? And he said, well, I think they put the wrong lens in my eye. I'd gone back to the doctor and...
His father didn't remember exactly what had happened at his last doctor's appointment, and the office was closed anyway. How could a local doctor in Maryland access his dad's medical record in Boston? Through Medicare Blue Button, a computer program that allows patients to download their medical history into a simple text file on their smartphones and personal computers. Then, third-party applications that you download help organize this information. Mastashari knows more than a little bit about the subject. He heads the Federal Office of Health Information Technology, and it's his passion and his profession to promote electronic health records. So when he took his father to a local doctor, he handed over the phone with his dad's medical history. Mastashari predicts that soon everyone will have that information at their fingertips.
Within the next 12 months, if people want to, they will be able to get the same data that your doctors would send to each other, to have it come to you, and for you to be able to have a whole host of apps and services help you make sense of it, use it, share it, and help you take better care of your health and healthcare.
He says the federal healthcare law is designed to encourage patients to get more involved in managing their own health. Jennifer Lundblad, CEO of Stratus Health, a nonprofit in Minnesota, says the floodgates have opened for patients to use technology to manage their own care, particularly those who have chronic and expensive diseases.
Some parts of healthcare are so complex we need complex solutions, but some parts of healthcare can really be simplified. And with the prevalence of smartphones, let's use the smartphone tool that that patient already has.
But there are also worries.
Privacy and security is one that comes to mind.
For instance, what happens if you lose the smartphone with your medical information? What happens to your health data if the app company storing it goes out of business?
Be aware before you share, because that's your best defense.
Devin McGraw heads the Health Privacy Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. She says patients need to understand that when doctors and health plans store your electronic medical information, it's covered by federal privacy and security rules, rules that don't necessarily extend to your smartphone.
When you take possession of it and share it, stick it in an app, share it on the web, on a social networking site, it's not going to be protected beyond what's in the privacy policy for the app or what's on the privacy policy for the social networking site, and you have to read that.
Another problem is that physicians may not know whether records stored on a smartphone are complete. Attorney Scott Edelstein advises clients on developing mobile health applications.
There may be some data that the patient doesn't want to, you know, keep on their smartphone. Maybe there's very sensitive health information. Maybe there's information that they don't want other providers to know, but it could be information that would be very important for a provider to know, for example, in the event of an emergency.
Edelstein says errors or omissions could be disastrous. But in the case of Farzad Mastashari's father,
he had dry eye was the diagnosis.
The records on the phone had pointed to the problem. It was an easy treatment that salvaged the Thanksgiving weekend. For NPR News, this is Elizabeth Stewicki.
Elizabeth's story was part of a collaboration between NPR, Minnesota Public Radio, and Kaiser Health News.